Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, we consider who lost Iraq. Also, an extended conversation with Frank DeFord about his new baseball novel. But first, an unexpected bright spot in the troubled housing market today. The Commerce Department says new home sales increased 2.8% last month. Experts had expected a decline of about 1.5%. But that seems to be about the only good news in the housing market these days. Following the collapse of the subprime mortgage industry, 21,000 workers in the mortgage and lending businesses have lost their jobs this month alone. And MoodysEconomy.com estimates that 1.7 million homes will be lost in foreclosure this year and next. Today, we're going to take a look at the mortgage industry from someone who is in the trenches. Patrick Schwartfeger is a mortgage broker with Windsor Capital, the third largest mortgage brokerage company in the country. He's based in San Francisco and joins us now. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Happy to be here.
Thanks for doing this. First of all, I understand the problems in the lending industry are just getting started because interest rates on the so-called subprime mortgages are going to reset in next 2 years. What effect is that going to have?
Well, the effect of resetting interest rates is interesting because you can see it coming. It's on the horizon. The vast majority of what they call subprime loans are fixed for either 2 or 3 years. And when those reset, they reset from a fixed interest rate. So they jump from an interest rate that might today be 6 or 6.5 or 7%, all the way up to 10.25%.
Wow, that's quite a jump. So give us an example. Give us an anecdote about a customer that you have that might be going through this.
Well, I actually have a number of customers that are in similar situations. I think most mortgage brokers are in the same situation as I am. A gentleman owns a condo, and it's worth $265,000, and his loans are also worth $265,000. His payment's set to adjust in about the next month or so, and his payment's going to almost double. So his back's really against the wall, and he needs to do something. Meanwhile, the value in his property has not gone up the way it has historically in the past. So he's really got his back against the wall.
Right. So he's in a tough situation, as are a lot of people. As we mentioned, 1.7 million homes are expected to go into foreclosure in the next 2 years. Can you give us an example of how this is affecting people you're working with? I mean, are you seeing people actually facing foreclosures?
Yeah. I mean, these are awful situations to see, particularly being in the profession. But I have a couple, actually, that I've worked with in the past, and they were very enthusiastic to get in on the housing boom 2 years ago and really wanted to purchase a house that I thought was beyond their means, but they were enthusiastic and wanted to do it. Today, roughly 2 years later, indeed, the payments were more than they could handle, and the value of the property has actually gone down since they bought it. So again, in their situation, it's just a waiting game. They are inevitably facing foreclosure at some point. They're already delinquent, and it's just a question of how much time goes by before the bank knocks out the door.
Yeah, and Patrick, you know, not to put you on the hot seat here, but, you know, were you partially responsible for that? I mean, as you look back, should you have said, no, don't buy this house, you can't do it?
Well, it's an excellent point, Anthony, and this is the balancing act that we all play in this industry. Absolutely, and in fact, I did just that. I said, listen, this is really going to be a tough purchase for you guys. You're going to be house poor. It's going to be a large payment. Are you sure you want to do it? And then you get the customer's perspective that comes in and says, yes, we want to do it. Our mother's going to be moving in. She's going to be helping to pay the bills. We can do it. We can do it. We can do it. And so I'm caught in the middle saying, listen, I can do the loan. The market allows for a product that I can put this together. I don't think it's a good idea, but I'll do it if you want me to. They said, let's do it. And the rest is history.
Right. Now, we also hear about the so-called jumbo loans. These are loans for more than $417,000. And in some parts of the country, Boston, for example, where I'm sitting being one of them, they're very normal. They're pretty much required for an average house loan. What's happening to people you know in terms of jumbo mortgages?
Well, I'm here in California, so I'm in the same situation as you are. Most of the home prices are a lot higher than they are in different parts of the country. The stock market essentially repriced the debt about three weeks ago, so interest rates all of a sudden jumped up quite a bit for jumbo mortgages. And I have a gentleman who has a 5-1 ARM, which is a mortgage that's fixed for 5 years, and then it resets. It's going to be resetting in about a year. If we didn't refinance, it would jump all the way up to about 7.75. So again, his payment would be expected to double.
Now, listen, this represents a huge change in the industry. I mean, the meltdown of the subprime mortgage industry and all the ripples that have gone out. Can you explain, though, sort of specifically in terms of the mechanism, why the amount of credit available to people is drying up?
Starting in the early 80s, 1981, 82, interest rates were very high at the time, and guidelines, underwriting guidelines, were very, very strict. The trend ever since then has been towards looser guidelines, looser guidelines, looser guidelines. We can do more and more and more things. Lower and lower credit scores will qualify. And that trend continued, and it peaked really in 2003. And that was coupled with the fact that the housing market started to go sideways. So historically, the houses would appreciate enough that if people got into trouble, you could always refinance and tap the accumulated equity if necessary to keep the wheels turning. Today, that's not happening anymore. We don't have that equity appreciation, and the guidelines are starting to tighten, and that's resulted in these higher delinquency rates.
So, Patrick, what advice do you have for people who are trying to buy a house now or are trying to move in this very difficult market?
Well, the basic advice that I would recommend is take a look at your credit report, make sure you clean that up as much as possible. And secondly, this might sound trite, but it really is true. Don't buy a house that you can't afford. Hmm. Get into a house where you can afford the payments. It matches your income. You can afford to make those payments. And if it's a smart decision for you as an individual, it's going to be a smart decision for the lender.
Okay, Patrick, thanks so much for joining us today and clarifying some of this. It made a lot of sense.
I appreciate the time.
Patrick Schwartfeger is a mortgage broker with Windsor Capital and author of Loans and Lenders, A Guide for Buyers and Borrowers. He spoke to us today from San Francisco. Next, we thought we'd take a break from the hard news on this Friday and spend a few moments looking at our national pastime with a longtime lover of the game. The Entitled, A Tale of Modern Baseball, is Frank DeFord's new novel about an old-time manager and his superstar outfielder. Howie Traveler never made it as a player, but he's the kind of manager who breathes baseball, who understands the tiny details of the game better than anyone. He's a natural. Jay Alcazar is also a natural, but in a different way. Alcazar is a modern star, a natural hitter with endless talent, privilege, and the reputation as the best player in the game. The Entitled tells a story about their relationship, modern baseball, a rape allegation, and what happens when privilege and entitlement collide with the real world. Author Frank DeFord is a 6-time National Sports Writer of the Year and, of course, well-known to NPR listeners, and he joins us now. Frank DeFord, welcome.
Thank you very much, Anthony.
Sure, and what a great book. I just love the story, vivid characters. They're so real, you feel you know these guys, and I suspect you do.
Oh, yeah. They're both, neither one of them is based one-to-one on anybody, because that wouldn't be any fun. But they're composite of people that I've known, and not just in baseball, but in all sports through the years.
Hmm. Well, talk about the first protagonist, the old manager, Howie Traveler. He never made it as a player, but he's a great manager.
These are guys like the NCOs in the Army who really make the Army work as much as anything else, even though they aren't the generals. And Howie has just adored baseball, never very good at it himself. Good enough to play in the minor leagues and to get, as they say, a cup of coffee in the majors, but has hung on, and it's cost him. This love has cost him. It's cost him much of his family. It's cost him a chance to do anything else, but he has finally arrived at the top. He's a manager of a major league team.
You have him managing a Cleveland Indians team that is just on the edge of greatness, and this is his big moment, really.
And I have to tell you, Anthony, when I plotted this book in 2004, the team I had was the Boston Red Sox.
No kidding.
Because I needed a loser. You know, I wasn't going to get a chance with the winner. And then I had to switch, and I switched to the White Sox, and then they won.
Oh, my.
And I'm very big in Cleveland because they think maybe this is an omen that they're going to win this year. But anyway, Howie has finally gotten his chance, and it is the Indians, a team that hasn't won since 1948.
And Howie Traveler, you tell us in the book, he knows which way the ball is going to bounce off a broken bat, whether a player wears his pants glance high or low. He's a manager who sometimes ignores statistics and numbers and goes with his gut. Are you thinking about him as sort of a dying breed? Because there's something wistful in your description of him.
Yeah, he is. I think how he is sort of represents old-time baseball and the way that it used to be and the way that he wants players all to wear their pants right and to do things right and to honor the game and not just make a buck from it. Mm. How he loves baseball, I suppose, more than he even understands it.
Now, standing in contrast to Howie is the other main character in the book for whom the entitled is named, Jay Alcazar. And I'm wondering, there's a passage on page 112 that I wanted you to read, if you could. It's that graph that begins, Alcazar looked at it this way. It sort of talks about his sense of entitlement.
Delighted. Here we go. Alcazar looked at it this way. Most of the retinue that surrounded him was there to serve him. His agent Montague, first of all, and Brenda, Montague's secretary, who answered all his mail and dutifully reminded him of obligations and birthdays. The team's public relations people, Dougie Flint, was especially good at making sure that different girlfriends were separated from each other at the home games, not to mention Flint's even trickier task of separating the seats for the girlfriends and the wives of the married players. Then there were Alcazar's reps at Louisville Slugger and Nike, the Indian coaches and doctors and trainers, every medical whim immediately attended to, plus massages, the equipment guys, the clubhouse guys, everything your heart desires, food and drink, batteries for your appliances, charging for your cell phones. The best attendants even had Mother's and Father's Day cards stamped, you understand, available in May and June, because who could expect big leaguers to remember such a thing themselves, let alone actually purchase Hallmarks?
That's the way it is, right?
It's the way it is.
Yeah. What is the effect on the game? I mean, these players clearly deserve the money they make in the sense that the business is making the money, but is there something corrosive about this enormous sense of entitlement?
I don't think that it hurts the game as much as it hurts the players as people. I think that when the game starts, and I'm always sort of sentimental about this, I believe that almost all players forget how much money they do have, and their just instinctive athletic sense comes in, and they go out there and they play. I mean, you see guys diving into the stands after balls and risking life and limb. But I do think that what this sense of entitlement does, it wounds them terribly as human beings and gives them a sense of privilege that hurts them in their private lives.
Mm. As we look around the game today and perhaps some of the troubles in the game, I mean, I'm sure this comes up in this conversation with you all the time, but I'm thinking of Barry Bonds, Jambi, I'm thinking of the whole brouhaha about performance-enhancing drugs. Does this problem come from that sense of entitlement?
Yeah. I mean, they may be illegal, but hey, I'm a big league ball player. I can do what I want to. And that pervades almost every element of their lives. And, of course, women become the biggest perk of all, the greatest entitlement. Think of yourself, Anthony, at the age of 24, 25, you're worth $5 or $6 million. Mm. Everybody adores you. It's a glamorous profession that you're in. Nobody ever says no to you. Women are throwing themselves at you. Think how hard it would be for me. I'd have a horrible time keeping my head on straight under those circumstances. I'm almost amazed that any of these guys come through unscathed.
Yeah, right. Well, that sums up my life pretty well. That's Frank DeFord talking about his new novel, The Entitled. We'll return with more with Frank, talking about his own thoughts as a longtime observer of the game. And later in the show, Who Lost Iraq? One foreign policy veteran says it's important to learn the lesson so we don't repeat the same mistakes in the future. Stay with us here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with NPR commentator Frank DeFord, author of The Entitled, which tells the story of an old-time baseball manager and his hotshot star. And Frank DeFord, let's talk about the central conflict and action in this story. It revolves around an allegation of date rape against the star player Jay Alcazar, and we're not giving anything away here because this is all laid out early in the book. And it's about what Howie Traveler, the old manager, saw one night in the hotel where the team was staying.
Yeah, Howie sees something which would strengthen the woman's story much more. I mean, this is obviously one of those classic he said, she said situations, and Howie knows that if he reports what he saw to the police, that it's going to give her much more credibility than exists right now. And so So it's an ethical conundrum for Howie as well as a professional one, because he knows very well that if he damages the star, it's going to ruin him as a player and maybe even put him behind bars in the extreme. And so he's caught up in a very difficult situation.
And it's never entirely clear, at least it wasn't to me, exactly what happened. And it seems you make an effort to paint Jay as a sympathetic figure.
Well, my thinking was very clear. If I made Jay to be a dumb jock and altogether greedy and altogether selfish, then you weren't going to like him. And you certainly weren't going to believe him when he said that he didn't rape the woman. It was important that he not only be attractive and stylish and bright, but that he be wrestling with the whole issue of entitlement and what it means to him.
Mm. It seems like the tension between these two guys, the old manager and his star outfielder, sort of represents that tension between traditional baseball and of modern baseball. I mean, of something that we're losing and something that the game has come to be increasingly.
Oh, yeah. They come from opposite poles, not only in the fact that Howie wasn't any good as a player and Jay is the best, but they're different generations. They're different races. One is a white-bred Midwesterner, and the other one is a Latin American. And beyond that, Jay has come from a very wealthy background. So these guys are just absolutely at different poles, which makes the relationship interesting because I won't go into it, but the relationship does grow and it does develop. And by the end, there's not only a mutual regard for one another, but even a certain amount of affection, which, of course, makes it even more difficult for Howie when he has to decide what to do, whether he should go to the police or not.
Mm. You've been a sports writer for a long time, and I'm just wondering how your view of this game has changed, your appreciation of the game, because it seems like in this book there are sort of two versions of what Frank DeFord might think of this game.
Yeah, I even have an old jaded, cynical newspaper man named Mickey Huey, who's sort of a Greek chorus.
Oh, I loved him. He was great, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of me in there.
Yeah,
there's a little bit of me in Mickey. There's a little bit of me in, but there's a little bit of me in Howie, too.
Hmm. But say more about Mickey, because actually I was going to ask you specifically. I said, I think there's a little self-portrait going on there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I do think that people like Mickey Huey, who've been around the game, come to hate it, just become so put off by all that happens that they don't see the beauty and the glory of the game anymore. And he wants to love the game the way he did when he was a kid. And he says, when I was a kid, I just loved it so much and loved the chance to be a sports writer. And now he just sees all the how tarnished it is. And I think I'm that way, too. I have seen, if you're around sports all the time, you see the underside of it. You know, you see the dirt. On the other hand, I think its beauty and its grace still shines through for me most of the time. I can be terribly, terribly sentimental about sports and about baseball most of all, because I think it's our most sentimental sport.
I think you're right. What about sports writers and athletes as friends? I think I read somewhere that you said they used to be good friends years back, but not so much anymore. What's changed?
Oh, I think the money has changed more than anything else. I mean, when I got into the business in the 1960s as a kid reporter, I wasn't making much less than the stalwarts in the game. If I was making $8,000, $9,000 a year and they were making $16,000 or $17,000, now we have to, you know, extrapolate that for what that would be in 2007 dollars. But it wasn't that much difference. And I see guys that I knew then and, if you will, covered then, and when we see each other now as old 60-year-olds, I think we greet each other more like sort of fraternity brothers than we do as subject and writer. And I think it's the money that's just changed so much. And along with the money comes that sense of entitlement. Why would you put up with some writer today? Well, why would you do that? Where in the old days they did.
Well, you could ask some writers, Frank DeFord, why you've put up with covering sports for so long, and baseball in particular. I mean, what keeps you there? Because you've shown yourself to be an accomplished author and writing outside of sports, but this is still your love, apparently.
First of all, it's what people expect of me. I mean, it does work that way. NPR has not asked me to do a weekly commentary on science or religion. I mean, I'm looked upon as a sports writer, and I understand that. But I also think I'm very, very lucky, Anthony, is that I have not had to be like Mickey Huey, who has been in the trenches every day. I've been able to stand back and be more of a commentator, or the stories that I've written have been deep and involved stories about the people.
Is sports a good sort of context for writing about people in that way?
I don't think there's any question that it's so. I mean, after all, it's wins and losses every day. You go through an awful lot at a very young age, athletes do, and they also get to the top of the mountain. I mean, so you see the extremes in life. I remember when I was about, I guess, 30 years old, and I had been the basketball writer at Sports Illustrated for 5 or 6 years. I mean, that was a pretty good job, you know, for the prime weekly magazine. Mm. And I went to the editor and said, I just can't do this anymore. I don't want to be Mr. Basketball. I want to concentrate on writing about people and issues and that sort of thing. And I said, I got to leave, you know, unless you can give me another job here. And he could. And I was then allowed to become a feature writer, which is what I wanted. But the games are wonderful to see. We all love games. But I didn't want to write about games. I wanted to write about people and what that meant.
Well, it's a great book, Frank DeFord. Thanks so much for coming in to talk about it. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Anthony.
That's Frank DeFord. His new book is called The Entitled, A Tale of Modern Baseball. Monday on Here and Now, a former college president advocates lowering the drinking age. He says that would allow colleges to stop policing illegal drinking and start teaching kids how to drink responsibly. That's Monday. Still ahead today, the swamp blues music of Lazy Lester, Here and Now. Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Given the grim news in recent days about the war in Iraq, it seems appropriate to ask, who lost Iraq? Can Americans blame one set of leaders, President Bush, Dick Cheney, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld? How about a compliant Congress where a majority of opposition Democrats voted for the war? What about the media, which acted as gullible cheerleaders for the most part? And what about the country's long-held policies of preemptive war, of nation-building, and its so-called war on terror? Were they to blame? James Dobbins says the current debate over U.S. failures in Iraq must move beyond easy conclusions and politically charged finger-pointing. Dobbins served as Assistant Secretary of State under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. He says in order to avoid future foreign policy debacles, the country needs to understand the complex web of failures that led to the mess in Iraq. His essay in the current edition of Foreign Affairs magazine is called Who Lost Iraq? And James Dobbins joins us now from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. If we accept that Iraq is lost, and that's an underlying premise of your piece, why is it wrong for people to single out the key players in the administration who led the nation into this war?
I don't think we actually have to accept that Iraq is lost. I think that most people accept that the decision to invade Iraq was flawed, that the war was probably unnecessary, and that in any case the occupation in the early years was mishandled. And so I think whether you believe it was unnecessary or simply conclude that the initial efforts were mishandled, there's a good deal of responsibility to be allocated and a number of lessons that need to be learned.
Mm. Well, let's talk about some of those lessons. You do start your piece by looking at the Bush administration, who you say failed to foster or encourage debate or discipline dissent in the lead up to the war. That's a big lesson, it seems to me.
I think that's in many ways the key lesson, that both the president and the secretary of state adopted a management style that didn't foster disciplined dissent and structured debate, that didn't allow them to inform themselves through a process of dialectic debate among stakeholders with information and opinions that that would have been relevant and enlightening had they been consulted. Mm. I mean, it's healthy that state and defense don't agree. They have different information. They have different backgrounds, and a president can learn a lot by drawing out those disagreements and conducting those debates.
On the other hand, isn't there a cost to bear in some cases for a long, sort of slow debate? I mean, at a certain point, we elect our leaders to be decisive, and if they have to take months at a time to solicit and encourage endless debate about issues of national importance, can't that in itself be risky?
It can. On the other hand, there was no great rush in invading Iraq. There were no time deadlines that were imposed by developments in Iraq itself. The deadlines were largely imposed by the American political calendar and a more extended debate certainly could have been arranged. But there's no doubt that the debate, even if it's conducted quietly and confidentially, will leak, and it will make it more difficult for the administration to mobilize public opinion in support for the decision it chooses. My view is, however, that going to war should be hard, not easy. The founding fathers intended that these debates be held in open session in the American Congress. We've reached such a point that the debate to go to war in Iraq wasn't even conducted in any concerted fashion within the executive branch. Mm.
And in fact, in your piece, you argue there's more than enough blame to go around, that it needs to be shared by many entities and institutions, policymakers. And let's consider some of those. One of the players, Congress, correct? I mean, what's the lesson learned there?
Well, I think that the responsibility for examining the case for war, critically examining it, opposing it perhaps, but in any case critically examining it, belongs in the first instance to the opposition party. And if the opposition fails to take up that burden, if it basically ducks that responsibility, then it's hard to argue that the press and others didn't do their job in examining these assumptions and arguments more carefully.
Hmm. And you feel that that's what happened in a big way. The Democrats just ducked that responsibility. My memory is of a very lonely Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia standing on the Senate floor pretty much all by himself. And that was about it.
Indeed. I mean, in the months leading up to the invasion of Iraq, the primary opponents were, in fact, moderate Republicans of the George H.W. Bush school, people like Brent Scowcroft and Senator Chuck Hagel, who were expressing some doubts.
Mm. You also talk about the problem, which has gotten a lot of coverage, obviously, the problem of flawed intelligence leading up to the war. We know now that the proponents of the war were able to cherry-pick intelligence to make their case for war. Some say that's an argument for more politically independent intelligence establishment, a more politically independent intelligence establishment. You say that would be a mistake. Why?
Yeah, I mean, the intelligence community isn't a fourth branch of government. It's part of the executive branch, and it's important that it remain part of the executive branch and supportive of administration policy. I think it's important also that the American public and the Congress understand the limits of secret intelligence and the biases that are inherent in any intelligence assessment. Intelligence analysts don't get fired for failing to report good things. They do get fired for failing to report bad things, and therefore their assessments are always going to tend toward the negative. And if they're asked to assess whether or not Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, they're going to give you an assessment that simply by reason of their institutional biases and experiences is likely to be shaded toward the negative, toward the pessimistic. And one has to understand that and to some degree allow for it in assessing how seriously to take assessments which can never be delivered with 100% assurance of accuracy.
Mm. You also, in the piece, consider U.S. policies that led to the war. You write that policies like preemption, democracy promotion, nation building have been sullied by association with the war in Iraq. But you say the lesson should not be a wholesale rejection of these policies. Why not? I mean, if these are the policies that got us into this pickle in the first place.
Well, I think you have to go through them one by one. I think in terms of the policy of preemption, the United States has engaged in dozens of military campaigns since its creation in 1776. Only two of those were in response to an attack upon the United States. So there's no real doubt that the United States is prepared to use armed force to protect its interests and its allies and is not necessarily going to wait to be attacked. On the other hand, embracing preemption as the centerpiece of your declarative strategy kind of pushes it in the face of everybody else in the world and creates resistance to getting international support when you actually do intend to use force as we did in Iraq. So I'm not arguing that we drop preemption as a policy option. I'm arguing that we drop it as a centerpiece of our declarative policy.
Well, James Dobbins, it's a very provocative piece. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much. That's James Dobbins, who directs the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He served as Assistant Secretary of State under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. His piece, Who Lost Iraq, appears in the current edition of Foreign Affairs magazine. It's here and now. Some colleges are finding that it is getting easier to be green. Earlier this summer, more than 280 schools introduced a pledge to make their campuses carbon neutral. And here are some examples of schools moving in that direction. Yale University, 2/5 of the dining hall food comes from local organic farms. At Oberlin, there is a solar building that produces 30% more energy than it consumes. And Arizona State has introduced sustainability as a field of study. When students return to Plymouth State University in Plymouth, New Hampshire after Labor Day, some will move into the school's newest dorm called Langdon Woods. In the often freezing state of New Hampshire, the green building used only 4 days of heating oil last winter, thanks to a system that uses recycled steam. It's been home for Plymouth Speaker of the Student Senate, Peter Laufenberg, who joins us now. Also on the line is the university's VP for Financial Affairs, Bill Krangle. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Anthony.
Peter, you first. Can you describe what your green dorm room looks like?
It honestly looks like any other dorm room you've seen on any other campus. I live in a suite. I have four roommates who have their own single room, but then we also share a common room. One of the features you notice in our suite is that our bathroom is different. It's compartmentalized, and we have our own shower, our own toilet, our sinks, which are all separate. And each one of these has their own green feature in them. I mean, sinks are reduced flow. You have toilets that have, as we like to joke around, do flushes for different stuff. It's really just like any other dorm room, except has these green features throughout it.
Bill Krangle, let me come to you. I understand the new dorm room is almost 60% more energy efficient than the standard one, and as we mentioned, it produces more than it consumes. Can you explain how this works, how that's possible?
We have a cogeneration facility on campus whereby we generate all of our own electricity. When we built Langdon Woods, we constructed a water jacket around the engine that produces the electricity, and it captured the hot water from the engine, which we then pumped into Langdon Woods.
It's really extraordinary because for people listening to this program who might not know what New Hampshire winters are like, they're quite long. The heating season can start sometimes as early as September and run right through to May.
Yeah, it's a little long, and we get about 80 inches of snow, and yeah, it can get chilly.
Back to you, Peter. In what other ways does the dorm save energy and money?
There's a lot of ways that it does, and one of the first things I think you'd notice if you were in Langdon Woods is the amount of natural light that comes in, as well as the way they've hooked up the hallway lights beyond motion sensors so that if there's no one in there in the hallways, the lights turn off. Other ways that you'd notice the savings is the way the building actually is constructed to save the wetlands, to save the stream, to save the woods that it's all around. So just by its construction and nature, it's being eco-friendly.
And Bill Krangle, where did this idea for this kind of dorm come from? Was there a push from students, or did the administration lead the way?
I would say both. We've been energy conscious in New Hampshire for a long time, primarily because of our winters and the like. And when we did a master plan in 2004, both the students and the administration and the faculty agreed that we wanted to do sustainable design. So it all sprung from that.
What about cost? Is this a lot more expensive to build a dorm like this compared to a conventional dorm?
If you start early in the process, it's not so bad. We estimate that the LEED process, which is from the Green Building Council, was about $240,000. With our heating savings, we got that back in the first year.
Peter, I'm curious to ask you a question about this green dorm as a teaching tool almost at the school. In other words, are people who live in the dorm concerned about the environment? Are they made more aware of the environment because of this dorm?
I think when you talk about the type of students that are in there, you have a mix. You have your general students who just want to live in a new dorm, and you also have those who are conscientious about the environment. And I think by living in Langdon Woods, you are learning about the environment and eco-friendly initiatives. Just by the fact of all this stuff around you, you realize the impact a building has on the environment and that what we've been doing at Plymouth through Langdon Woods is really making a difference, and that spills over into other stuff throughout your life.
Hmm. Well, listen, thank you both for taking time today to talk to us about this.
You're welcome.
That's Peter Laufenberg, who lives in Plymouth State University's new green dorm, Langdon Woods. We also spoke to Bill Krangel, Vice President for Financial Affairs at Plymouth State University. To see what the school's green dorm looks like and to link to information about the climate commitment among the nation's colleges, go to our website, here-now.org. Brooks, It's Here and Now.
I don't have to worry about anything. She's my baby, and goodness knows she got to give her only love.
We're wrapping up this week with a trip back in time to a Friday night in a juke joint, a Louisiana juke joint, for the sound known as the Swamp Blues. This is the music that bubbled up from the mix of country, Cajun, Zydeco, and blues from people who made their living in the swampland of southwest Louisiana. People like Lightnin' Slim, Katie Webster, Slim Harpo, and Lazy Lester. Lazy Lester was not yet 25 when he made this record, Sugar Coated Love, in 1958. Lazy Lester's big break came from Staying on a Bus, which we'll hear about more later, at a time when hit songs broke on a DJ's whim and recording contracts were written on paper bags. Much has changed in the country, in music and juke joints, but Lazy Lester still has the blues and is still playing the harp. And we caught up with Lester at the studios of KCHO in Chico, California, just before he headed off to this weekend's Boston Blues Festival. And Lazy Lester, welcome.
Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. We hear that you gave up a fishing date to join us today. Is that true?
I sure did.
Tell us, well, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us rather than looking for those fish. Why are you called Lazy Lester?
Because I'm never in a hurry. That's the way I always felt about my music, you know. I always felt relaxed, you know, doing it the way I felt. That's not really lazy, you know, but...
Sounds like relaxed, laid back.
Yeah, relaxed, yeah. That's what they both say, laid back.
So tell us, if you would, the story about that day on the bus with Lightnin' Slim. He was on his way to J.D.J. Miller's studio in Crowley, Louisiana, where so much of that swamp sound was recorded.
That's right. Well, I was on my way to Rain, Louisiana, which is 7 miles east of Crowley. And I saw Lightnin' on the bus, but he didn't know who I was, but I knew who he was. And I asked him, I said, where are you going, Lightnin'? He said, I'm going out to Crowley to do some recording. I said, I think I'll go on out there with you and see what's going on with this recording business. You know, I didn't tell him I was a musician at all. He didn't know.
He didn't know that you played the harp.
No, he didn't know. Anyway, we got the rain. I offered the bus driver the fare, which was a quarter, to go on to Crowley. He said, now, I heard you talk with this guy, so you keep that today. Maybe your lucky day. So we got to Crowley and walked in and met Jay. And he asked, like, who is the fellow you got with you? He said, I don't know. He said, his name is Leslie Johnson or something like that. I said, yeah, I'm Leslie Johnson. He said, what brings you? I said, I just came over here to listen and see what this recording thing was all about. He said, well, we're going out to Texas and find Y. Bill, the harmonica player. Off we went out to Port Arthur, Beaumont, Orange, all over the place, looking for Y. Bill Phillips, which he never found him. Came back to Lake Charles by some of his kin folks. They hadn't seen him. So we came on back to the studio. And he said, well, I didn't say, I'm going to have to get over to Henry. He called for Henry, and his mother said, Mr. Miller, Henry just left, and he go home to Baton Rouge because he got to go back to school. I said, well, uh-oh. Say, Henry's gone. I told him to go give me an A and a G because I knew that's the two keys Lightning played. So he went and got me the A and G. I recently got the guitar and tuned it. And he looked at me, he blew his mind when I tuned the guitar with the harmonica because I knew I wanted it right. And I handed the guitar, and he hit off Sugar Plum, and I hit the harmonica. He said, whoa, wait a minute. I'm running all over the world looking for him and got him right here with me. why didn't you tell me? I said, you didn't ask. So that started it right there.
Now, you played on that session with Lightning Slim and also for Lonesome Sundown and others. And then on your own, you made I'm a Lover, Not a Fighter, which was a hit for you back in 1958. We want to listen to a little bit of that.
Well, there's people say I'm lazy. There's lots they don't know. Where I'm in the mood, I can't go, can't go. Cause I'm a lover, not a fighter.
You're one of the last survivors of the swamp blues that was popular in the mid-1950s, and music that grew out of the fusion of the country and Cajun tradition of white immigrants, the Zydeco, and blues of the African-American experience. We can hear your love of the country blues on songs like Nothing But the Devil. Let's take a listen to that.
Well, you know yourself the good, you ain't treating your daddy right. You leave home in the morning and you don't come home tonight. It ain't nothing but the devil made you treat me the way you do. I'm gonna break out just like the measles. I'm gonna be all over you.
That's a great sound. I love that. Can you tell me how you grew to love country music?
That's the first thing I ever heard in my life was country music and bluegrass. They had this guy who used to come to the house to play cards with my dad. They had some fiddle players, banjo players, guitar and harmonica players, and that country just stuck to me, you know, and been with me ever since, and I still love it.
When we think about the history of the blues in America, it's a story of race and region, of an era. It was sometimes difficult business, people signing contracts on one sheet of paper, and the musicians not always faring so well.
That's for sure. We all got ripped off. I hate to speak about that part of it, you know, but that's the reason I walked away from the music.
Really?
One of the reasons. Oh, yeah. I was doing better driving a truck, doing construction and playing music because I wasn't making any money on it. I still had the love for it. And still got the love for it. Gonna have the love for it.
You on my side.
A wonderful tune. Now, you're a fan of New Orleans rhythm and blues as well. Let me ask you about the Lee Dorsey tune that you covered, Sitting Here in La La Waiting for My Yaya. It's on your CD, Blues Stop Knockin'. What is it about that sound that appeals to you?
Just the tune itself, you know. I mean, it's not big words. I mean, I don't even know what yaya means. Lala.
Well, here it is. Let's listen to Yaya as we say goodbye and thank you to Lazy Lester.
Yeah, baby, hurry, don't be worried, oh.
Lazy Lester is at the Boston Blues Festival this weekend. For more on the festival and his touring schedule, visit our website, here-now.org. And Lazy Lester, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Very much welcome.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Robin Young returns on Monday. Have a great weekend and join us again Monday, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.